Should a company really have to say who owns it? Why sunshine and shell companies don't always mix? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In San Francisco, I'm Molly Wood, sitting in for Kai Rizdahl, who's on a reporting assignment. It's Thursday, April 7th. Happy to be here with you. We have been following the fallout from the Panama Papers all week, those millions of documents leaked from a law firm that are throwing shade on politicians, actors, race car drivers. But perhaps most of all, it's put the issue of shell companies in the public eye in a big way. But this question, whether companies should have to name their owners, has been bubbling away for years now. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson reports.
It sounds like a simple idea, require companies to say who owns them. But in practice, oh, so much more complicated. For starters, there are those who argue there are good legal reasons for shell companies, and then questions about how and where ownership data is collected, whether it's verified, updated, what the ownership threshold should be. Way back in 2008, former Senator Carl Levin, a Democrat, started sounding the alarm about shell companies when he was in Congress.
The law enforcement community told us that the misuse of corporations with hidden owners creates a real problem for them in terms of enforcing our laws, whether it's laws against drug dealers or laws against corruption or laws against terrorism.
He introduced a bill that would require states to collect information about who actually owns the company when it's incorporated. It's been reintroduced several times over the years, but
it's just stalled.
One of the groups opposed to it, the National Association of Secretaries of State, thinks ownership information is better collected at the federal level. Or by banks. The Treasury Department is working on a new rule, also years in the making, to get banks to gather ownership data on their corporate accounts. Shruti Shah is with the nonprofit Transparency International USA.
As of now, U.S. financial institutions, while they are required to do customer due diligence, they are not really required to determine and verify the true beneficial owner of their corporate clients, and that's a loophole.
But the banks don't really want this job either. The American Bankers Association said in a statement that since the government creates legal entities, the job should fall to them. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
There's been an increase in the last few years in high-deductible health plans, and employers have been picking plans that ask workers to cover more out of pocket as they try to keep their own costs in check. So as we pay bigger chunks of our healthcare costs, that raises the question, what's the role of doctors in this new economic reality? Well, a report this week suggests that the docs are rolling up their white sleeves and getting into the nitty-gritty more than they used to, although some say not as much as they should. From our health desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports.
If doctors increasingly talk to their patients about money, the question is whether those conversations are effective. To answer that, a research team at Duke analyzed 3,000 transcripts of patient-doctor visits. Co-author Wynne Hunter reads from one, where a physician compares the cost of several hormone therapy treatments.
Doctor, Eromycin currently is still a branded drug, so it's $240 a month. The other, the Femara, is still branded also. That's $240 a month. The Arimidex, though, that's generic. It's like $8 or $10 a month. Patient? Okay.
This new paper finds that somewhere between 25 to 40% of the time, money comes up in these appointments. To those who believe in more transparency, the thinking goes this will arm patients with the information they need to make an informed choice.
We have specialized knowledge, and we need to be able to help our patients navigate this.
That's Dr. Chris Moriades from the University of California, San Francisco. But there's one concern when money comes into the equation, explains Harvard economist David Cutler.
The physician should be only looking out for the health interests of the patient. And that's really what the sanctity of the exam room is about.
Some argue money issues can confuse patients, prompting them to make decisions based on their pocketbook, not their health. But Cutler says people already make these choices, and studies show they often make bad ones. Given that, Cutler believes the physician's role must be to understand that a patient's financial reality is part of their overall health. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, oil, the dollar, and stocks all just dropping like stones. We'll have the sad music, I mean the details, when we do the numbers. By By every measure, the coal industry is in serious trouble. You think those oil prices have been in free fall? Well, the price of coal is down about 75% since 2011. Last week, the country's two biggest coal mines each laid off roughly 15% of their workers. That's about 500 people, most of them in northeast Wyoming, where coal is the big game in town. Some analysts believe that if the coal market shrinks, things will improve, demand will come back, prices will go up. But as Wyoming Public Radio's Stephanie Joyce reports, things are going to get a lot worse for coal before or if they get better.
Last Friday, anyone driving past the Holiday Inn Express in Douglas, Wyoming, might have remarked on the large number of pickup trucks in the parking lot. If they stuck around for a while, they would have seen that most of those pickup trucks belonged to stony-faced men who emerged from the hotel one by one, clutching blue folders. Kyle Christiansen was one of them.
Yeah, they put us all in one room. They told us all they were sorry that it was a layoff.
Before receiving the news, Christiansen had worked at Peabody Energy's North Antelope Rochelle mine in northeast Wyoming, the largest coal mine in the U.S. He was planning to retire in the next couple of years, but now he's not sure he'll have the money.
I'll check around. I know where a few mining jobs are, and maybe I can get on there in Nevada or Colorado.
Like many people in this part of the world, Christiansen blames what's happening in the coal industry squarely on the federal government.
Obama's put us out of business.
That's a common sentiment among Wyoming's political leaders and the coal companies. In a press conference addressing the layoffs, Governor Matt Mead largely blamed federal rules and regulations for reducing demand for coal and said he would continue to fight them.
We have filed what we believe is a record number of lawsuits trying to address the situation with coal.
But regulation is arguably the least of coal's problems, at least in the short term. Coal's number one enemy?
The price of natural gas is the lowest it's been in 14 years.
That's a television news report from December. Natural gas prices have fallen even further since then, eating into coal's markets. Global demand for coal is also falling, which has sunk plans to export American coal to Asia. Despite those daunting realities, Governor Mead has promised that he will double down on coal, but says he is worried about the potential for an exodus from the state.
People need to be able to work and feed themselves and feed their families and have insurance. And when good jobs at the coal mine are lost, it's understandable that they may look elsewhere.
Frank Thompson may soon be looking. Before getting laid off, he worked as a diesel mechanic for Peabody Energy for 7 years. He'd like to stay in Wyoming, but he's a single dad and says in the end, he'll go wherever he can find a job that will allow him to provide for his son.
Have you told your son? How are you going to tell your son?
I talked to him a little bit about it. You know, he's 7 years old, so he kind of sees it as some time to hang out. But I don't think he really realizes that this could be, us moving away from here.
But Thompson is actually glad to have been laid off now. He got a decent severance package, which is something he's not sure workers who get laid off down the line will receive. And these layoffs are not likely to be the last. I'm Stephanie Joyce for Marketplace.
That story comes to us from Inside Energy. It's a public media collaboration focused on America's energy issues. All right, let's take a little break and talk about guilty pleasures for a moment, such as snuggly sheepskin boots, the kinds that are favored by celebs, despised by fashionistas, adored despite their humble appearance. Yep, I'm talking about Uggs. Try as you might, Ugg haters, they are not going away. Legend has it that Uggs started out as cheap sheepskin slippers worn mostly by Australian surfers decades ago. But flash forward to celebrity status and a sudden resurgence in sales. Marissa Meltzer wrote all about the boots and their undying popularity for The Guardian. Hey, Marissa.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. So I have to say that this story is close to my heart because I own Uggs and and one day I left my...
Tell me your story.
I know. One day I left my Uggs on top of the heater vent. And then I put them on and I was like, well, that's what love feels like. Warm Uggs.
Right?
So surfers are cool and skaters are cool and they played a role, it sounds like, in the popularity. But when did the celebrities come in?
The celebrities came in, I would say, in probably the early 90s. There was a certain kind of celebrity like Pamela Anderson or someone like Kate Hudson who grew up on the beach and wore Uggs as part of that Venice lifestyle that they were living. And they slowly caught on until, you know, they were this kind of early 2000s juggernaut, really.
So then came the wave of haters, and they still exist.
Inevitably.
Yeah. Do they hate comfort? Who are these people? Who are the haters?
There are people who hate vacation. No, you know, Uggs are ugly.
Yep.
I think that it's okay to say that. Fashion has a long history of liking things that are ugly, though, so that's probably not it. They skewed maybe a little bit sorority girl. You know, they just loved Uggs the way they love pumpkin spice lattes, and that's easy to make fun of.
But so here's this resurgence. Ugg sales in 2014-2015 up 12.6% to $1.5 billion. What's that about?
They're expanding. There are Ugg standalone retail stores. The first one was in Soho in New York. And Asia is such a big market for them that the highest grossing Ugg store in the world is Honolulu, which is not really, you know, Ugg-friendly weather. And it's not the surfers who are keeping them in business. It's the Asian tourists.
So just off the top of your head, can you think of another, I don't know, fashion item that has just been so unashamedly ugly that people just said, I don't care. It's so wonderful. I'm not going to, I guess Crocs.
Crocs. I'm a big fan of clogs. They're not as ugly, but they're definitely a little homely. Mm-hmm. I mean, so many caftans. I'm basically just going through my own wardrobe of things that I wear all the time.
That's Marissa Meltzer. She wrote Ugg, The Look That Refused to Die for The Guardian. Thanks so much, Marissa.
Thank you.
From the warm embrace of Uggs to the cold, dark void of space, the newest episode of Actuality, the podcast Marketplace produces in partnership with Quartz, is out today. And it's about internet space, like providing internet from space for all of us. The dream of a swarm of satellites surrounding the Earth is real. Get that episode and the whole new season by subscribing to Actuality in iTunes or wherever you podcast. Coming up,
most people in America really have not heard about it. If you travel to the Middle East, though, or anywhere else on the continent, it's a household name.
The family-run company responsible for some of the world's largest infrastructure projects. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 174 points, 0.9%, finishing at 17,541. The NASDAQ lost 72 points, 1.4%, closing at 48.48. And it was a sweep in the bad day land. The S&P 500 dropped 24 points, 1.2%, to end at 20.41. Some retail chains no longer release monthly sales figures. Buckle, which calls itself a denim destination for young adults, still does. Those sales figures, well, down. Buckle shares down 11%. Not a great day for Buckle's better-known competitors either. Abercrombie & Fitch down 3.4%. American Eagle down 4.6%. Gap off 4%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.69%. You're listening to Marketplace. You're listening to Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. So Victoria's Secret. Here's a company that knows a little something about less is more. In business, too. The lingerie maker is tightening its straps, let's say. It said today it's cutting 200 jobs, trimming its product lines, and steady yourselves, shifting its focus away from its famous catalogs. Marketplace's Adrienne Hill reports.
Yes, Victoria's Secret is scaling back its catalogs. Take a moment if you need to. All right, loss acknowledged.
We have to be very pragmatic in the retail world these days.
That's Wendy Lieben, head of WSL Strategic Retail. With all the online shopping we do, she says she's surprised the Victoria's Secret catalog has hung on as long as it has.
The reality is it's not the way women shop for themselves anymore, and it's certainly not the way men shop for women.
L Brands, the parent company of Victoria's Secret, is restructuring the brand. It'll focus on lingerie, its pink line, and Victoria's Secret Beauty, and likely move away from the kind of fashion you wear over your undergarments. Lingerie and pink have been doing well for the company.
sticking with what they're best known for is the way to go.
Bridget Weishire is an analyst at Morningstar.
I think one of their biggest secrets to success, though, if you look at the products, would be bras.
Bras are complicated. Any woman knows bra shopping isn't always fun.
They don't want to go out and have to try on new stuff and figure out the right size. And, you know, once you get it right, you want to just kind of be able to go back and pick up that size and walk out of the store.
It's that kind of brand loyalty that's helped Victoria's Secret dominate the lingerie market and makes it easier for the company to depend less on the fickle world of fashion. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
I gotta confess, I'm starting to feel like the sky might be falling a little. First, Victoria's Secret gives up catalogs and those nice jeans I used to love. And now, I can't even believe I'm gonna say this, the Goodwill goes online. The king of thrift shops is trying to hip up its brand, revamp its image, and take the hunt for vintage gems into auction land. Andrew Stelzer has the story.
This is the Goodwill mothership for the San Francisco region. It's a massive, cavernous, bustling building. But thrifting is hot these days, and behind the scenes, Goodwill is way more than the warehouses and dusty shelves your grandma loves to browse for bargains. In the basement is a quiet room with tables covered in gold, jewelry, and piles of coins. Goodwill employee Janique Lee is using some high-tech equipment. She's painstakingly examining some donated goods that won't ever see the shelves of your local thrift shop.
Right now, I've just got done listing some necklaces and pendants. So this is one. This is actually Tiffany's.
The jewelry here is going straight to the internet after being verified.
It may be marked 14 karat gold, but when it's tested, it's not always 14 karat gold.
If you want that Tiffany necklace, you'll have to check out shopgoodwill.com. And since the nonprofit's mission is to maximize the value of every donation they get, you'll have to bid on it, along with thousands of other high-value items. The website is used by more than 100 regional Goodwills. That's more than half their stores. Brett Barchi is vice president of the retail division of Goodwill of San Francisco, San Mateo, and Marin Counties. He says that Goodwill sells on eBay, Amazon, and several other sites as well.
We were getting amazing product to our donations that if we place that in a local store, it's only going to receive the amount of attention of the number of customers coming through that location versus online. You've got hundreds of thousands of people that are online every day shopping that might see that product and be willing to pay more for it.
For San Francisco, the effort is paying off. E-commerce has become 10% of their overall business. The Portland, Oregon area Goodwill is setting the gold standard. Their online sales total more than $1 million a month. But one challenge is that clothing, which makes up 70% of Goodwill's donations, doesn't resell that well on the internet. Because, well, let's ask Suzanne Ruff, who's coming out of the flagship San Francisco store with her arms full of goodies.
I have always found a leather coat here that fits and looks great.
Did you know they have online Goodwill?
Nope, didn't know that.
Would you shop online?
Yeah, well, it's just fun coming in here.
So how to satisfy the in-store craving but still maximize the price for unique items? That's where the boutiques come in. Yes, you heard right, Goodwill boutiques. Here in San Francisco, Seattle, Denver, with retro interior designs and a more vintagey product selection. Dun & Bradstreet analyst Alex Beseda says it's all about appealing to that coveted consumer, young adults with disposable income.
They have this opportunity to connect with millennials who have this kind of social component to their shopping.
And so far, it's been working. ShopGoodwill.com has been growing at more than 15% annually. And of course, in 2017, there will be an app for that. In San Francisco, I'm Andrew Stelzer for Marketplace. We'll be right back.
You may or may not have heard about a company called Bechtel. The basic description is that it does engineering, construction, and project management. And it does, except on a huge scale. Like one of its first projects was building the Hoover Dam. It's done some of the most well-known infrastructure in the country, BART in San Francisco, the Big Dig in Boston, even the Yucca Mountain Nuclear Waste Repository in Nevada. And it's a modern American dynasty that's been privately run by family members for more than 100 years. The history of this company and its projects in the U.S. and around the world is the subject of a book called The Profiteers, Bechtel and the Men Who Built the World. Sally Denton is the author. She joins us now. Hi, Sally.
Hi, Molly. Thanks for having me.
So tell us a little more about Bechtel.
Well, it's the one of the largest privately held companies in America, and it's really interesting to me how few people and how few Americans really understand or even know about Bechtel. When I started the book 4 years ago, I would tell people what I was working on, and unless you lived in San Francisco and had BART or, you know, grew up in Boulder City, Nevada, where I did, which was the company town for Hoover Dam, which Bechtel built in the 1930s, most people in America really have not heard about it. If you travel to the Middle East, though, or anywhere else on the continent, it's a household name.
How did Bechtel get so big?
Well, they got so big by getting massive contracts, not just in the United States, but throughout the world. Warren Bechtel died in Moscow in 1933, and his son Stephen took over the company. He partnered with a man named John McCone, and McCone would go on to become head of the Atomic Energy Commission, and Bechtel would build the first breeder reactor, would get the contracts to build almost all of the nuclear facilities throughout the United States. And then McCone goes on to become director of the CIA under JFK, and where there are strategic interests for the United States in foreign policy during that time. Bechtel's at the front of getting many of the contracts into the Nixon administration, the Ford administration, the Reagan administration, all the way, you know, through to the invasion, the 2003 invasion of Iraq, and getting the first big contract to rebuild Iraq.
But you seem critical in the book of the influence or the amount of public money. In fact, you referred to Bechtel as a monopoly built with public money. Isn't there a point at which, I guess, who else are you going to hire if you're looking at the company that built the Bay Bridge and the Hoover Dam and did all this nuclear plant cleanup?
Yeah, that's a very – I'm not sure that I'm as critical of it as that I think it is a matter of – that should be a matter of serious public policy discussion in America. Who are going to – you know, what companies are going to build these mega projects? And so if it's going to be Bechtel, then why shouldn't the taxpayers have access, and why shouldn't there be some transparency about it and the taxpayers know why Bechtel indeed?
And is there another company or multiple other companies that can do projects on the same scale?
Oh, I think there are. Yeah, I think there are dozens of American behemoth companies. And in fact, what you will see in most of the current projects are that these companies team up together to do these public works projects. The difference is that this is a privately held company, and the lack of transparency makes it much more challenging to shine a spotlight on them.
Sally Denton is author of The Profiteers, Bechtel and the Men Who Built the World. Thank you so much, Sally.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
We reached out to Bechtel for a statement about the book, which has a lot more to say about the company's government contracts. Here's what we got from Charlene Wheelis, a Bechtel spokesperson. Quote, "This book distorts Bechtel's record and reputation and contains many inaccuracies, saying we did things we never did in places where we didn't work." We've got the rest of the response at our website. That's marketplace.org. And this final note before we go, the robots are taking our jobs at Taco Bell. The company has teamed up with Slack, the messaging app, to write a software program that lets you order food from Taco Bell by chatting with the Taco Bot. Taco Bot! It's an artificial intelligence program that takes orders and answers questions about the menu. Questions such as, seriously, what is a quesalupa? What is that? Anyway, then you order and you go pick it up, and it's almost like you talk to a real person, but it was a bot, a Taco Bot! Not to be a buzzkill, but It is an interesting trend as companies figure out how to employ fewer people because of rising minimum wages in some areas and then outsource the jobs to cute, fuzzy Slack bots. But you know what? Just ignore all that. Go ahead and say Taco Bot again. It's so fun. All right, that's all we've got for now. Today, the Dow fell 174 points, 0.9%. The NASDAQ lost 72 points, 1.4%. And the S&P 500 dropped 24 points, 1.2%. Golda Arthur, John Buckley, Deirdre Depke, Eve Epstein, Nancy Fargali, George Judson, Suzanne Levy, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our managing editor is Mark Miller. I am Molly Wood. Have a good night, and we'll be back again tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.